Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of our society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed, that they would prefer to lie even if the truth felt better. Our mission, therefore, is to know who is working against our interest, why they are doing so, how they are doing so, because exposing and condemning such schemes, even when they're religious, political, patriotic, isn't hateful. It's the most caring, the wisest thing we can possibly do. In our concluding hour, we're going to continue to review the great prophecy of Yeshayah, where God specifically told us what was going to happen in our immediate future and who was going to perpetrate the calamity that the world's going to endure. Because it points a finger, God's finger, directly at the United States of America. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, it is toll-free, 877-300-7645. A friend of mine sent me a story, a long-time individual who, the person that sent me the story that I've worked with for a very long time. He now is the administrator of the Yeshayah Forum. He has translated very substantial amounts of the Torah. He is really an extraordinary individual. He co-hosts the Friday Shabbat evening show with me as well. And at least once or twice a week, he'll send me a link which has interesting material. This one was no exception. I'm going to read from Wikipedia, because this is the link that he sent me. Lavina Johnson, who was born on July 27th, 1985. That means that she was born within days of the time my eldest son was born. She died, actually she was killed, on July 19th, 2005. At the time, she was a private first class in the United States Army. Her death, the Army officially ruled, was a suicide. But it has attracted international attention. The daughter of Dr. John Johnson, a service veteran himself, and Linda Johnson, was born and grew up in Missouri. The 5'1" African-American honor student enlisted in the Army immediately after graduating from high school. She was deployed to Iraq and stationed in Balad. She had been there for 8 weeks before she was killed on July 19, 2005, 9 days before her 20th birthday. Johnson's death was officially ruled a suicide by the Department of Defense. Now, I will tell you that I have studied. Like, I think I investigated every one of the first 500 fatalities of Americans in Afghanistan and in Iraq. I looked up everything that was written about what occurred and compared it to what the Department of Defense claimed. And the one thing that I found was ubiquitous is that the Department of Defense almost always lied. That they created a scenario that made the individual appear as if they lost their lives fighting an enemy army and that it was a great act of heroism, when the truth was nowhere close to that. It was almost always a direct result of either the officers in the Army sending an individual into a situation that was almost certain to get them killed. An issue of friendly fire where Americans killed their own. Or it was an accident where just a series of mishaps led to the individual's death. But the circumstances were always, almost universally, misrepresented by the military And, you know, the family members actually wanted to know the truth. You know, even if the truth didn't sound good, they wanted to know the truth. These were their sons and daughters. They wanted to know the truth. And as they investigated, the U.S. military was always the one who was caught lying. Now, that's the case here. Her death was ruled a suicide by the Department of Defense. It's not remotely possible. Her father became suspicious. Her father's a doctor. He became suspicious when he saw her body in the funeral home. And he decided to investigate. The Army initially refused to release information. That's the Army way. Oh, no, it's a secret. Can't tell you that. You know, people will die if you know our secrets. But under the Freedom of Information Act, after Representative William Clay raised questions about it at a congressional hearing during the congressional hearing over the Department of Defense's deliberate lies over Pat Tillman's death, information was forcibly released. The autopsy report and photographs revealed that Johnson had a broken nose. Don't often get a broken nose in a suicide. That's an extraordinarily painful thing that does not lead to death. No one breaks their nose when committing suicide. She had a black eye. You know, it's really hard to give yourself a black eye. Her teeth were knocked out. She had burns from a corrosive chemical all over her genitals. And the gunshot wound was completely inconsistent with suicide. Several reports have suspected that the chemical burns were in a desperate attempt to destroy DNA evidence of rape. A spokesperson from the House Armed Services Committee said in June 2008 that the committee was looking into Johnson's death, but they were not willing to commit to a formal investigation. Christopher Gray, Chief of Public Affairs for the U.S. Criminal Investigation Command for the Army, has said that the case remains closed as far as they're concerned. But a documentary film about Lavina Johnson's family struggle for justice was made in 2010. It's called The Silent Truth. On July 19, 2011, the criminal justice students in the Cold Case Investigation Research Institute, run as a student club by three universities, selected Johnson's case as their case for investigation. They tried to reconstruct the crime scene to shed light on this case, and their endeavor to do so has attracted worldwide attention to what happened to this 19-year-old victim of the U.S. military. Thought I would share that with you. There is related news. This was from the BBC this morning. Washington is the dateline. Reports of sexual assaults by members of the military rose 50% after the Pentagon began a vigorous campaign to get more victims to come forward, prompting defense officials to order a greater focus on prevention programs, including plans to review alcohol sales and policies. The reporting increased 50%. Now, it's already epidemic in the U.S. military. So reporting of sexual assaults rose 50%. The Army is celebrating that. They think that's really good. But officials are still unhappy with the low numbers of male victims who have reported sexual assault. And they say that there will be greater emphasis in the months ahead of getting men to come forward and seek help. Final data obtained by the Associated Press show that about 14% of the reports filed last year involve male victims. Defense officials said Wednesday that encouraging more men to report sexual assaults is a difficult challenge because male victims often worry that it will make people think that they are weak and trigger questions about their sexual orientation. In most cases, however, sexual orientation has nothing to do with the assaults, and it's more an issue of power or abuse. Can you imagine? You're the U.S. military, and you say, boy, now, this is proof. We're going to have a report to Congress. We're telling the media, boy, are we doing our job. We're getting an increase in the number of sexual assaults that are being reported, a 50% increase. And they think that's good. Well, you know, is it good that if they could prove that the number was strictly based upon the fact that a higher percentage of those who are abused are admitting that they are abused, because most of the victims of sexual assault in the U.S. military, some 80% of them, are unwilling to acknowledge they have been raped, because the most abusive rape actually comes at the hands of the U.S. military. Because the victim of rape, as is the case in Islam, is demeaned. They're isolated. They're accused of all manner of things. And the perpetrator isn't prosecuted. So there is this overwhelming tendency of why subject oneself to additional abuse. Now, in the civilian world, there is also a reluctance to press a case of sexual assault because the individual's life is going to be exposed and demeaned in front of a court. But at least within the civilian system of justice, there are protections for the individual that has been raped. In the military, there are no such things. In fact, the only way that we even have a remote chance of resolving the epidemic of rape in the U.S. military is to remove from the military the ability to prosecute its own. Rapes, in fact, any crime perpetrated in the military of the United States needs to be reviewed in a civilian court of law. Military jurisprudence must be terminated, otherwise this crime will continue to grow. And it is growing. It's not just that a higher percentage of women are admitting that they have been sexually abused in the military. It's a higher percentage are being sexually abused. I wanted to share this concluding comment with you regarding sexual abuse in the U.S. military. It says that while the number of reported assaults shot up sharply in 2013, defense officials said that based upon survey data and other information, they believe the increase was largely due to victims feeling more comfortable coming forward. Overall, there were 5,061 reports of sexual abuse filed in the fiscal year that ended September 30th, compared to 3,374 in 2012, for a 50% gain. It's pretty hard to imagine that a 50% gain and the reports of sexual abuse could be celebrated by any organization, and yet the U.S. military is doing so. They say, even though reports shut up 50% of sexual abuse, there is no indication that this increase in reporting constitutes an increase in crime, said Major General Jeffrey Snow, director of the Pentagon's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office. If you have a nincompoop like that, making that kind of a statement on behalf of the U.S. military, what do you think the likelihood is that the U.S. military is capable of solving this epidemic crime against women? Well, let me answer that question for you. Zero. That's the reason why jurisprudence in the U.S. military, and especially in sexual assault cases, has to be taken away from the U.S. military. A Michigan branch of the very powerful Service Employees International Union saw its membership and revenues plummet after after a reversal of a measure that forced caregivers tending to friends or relatives to be members with their dues paid by those who cared for them reversed. You see, more than 44,000 home-based healthcare workers parted ways with the SEIU, Healthcare Michigan, after learning that they did not have to join the union or pay dues, according to reports filed by the union with the U.S. Department of Labor. Thousands of employees were allegedly forced into union membership under a plan the SEIU successfully lobbied for with the United States government that classified even unpaid family members caring for elderly parents as health care workers that must be part of the union and must pay dues. Dues were then automatically collected from the care recipients' Medicare or Medicaid checks. Wow. And you want to know why healthcare is out of whack in America? This disgusting SEIU union, one of the largest in America, confiscated money from Medicare and Medicaid, U.S. taxpayer money, to pay dues for individuals who were family members taking care of their own family. Counted them as members of their union and confiscated the money. Huh. If that doesn't make you want to scream, doesn't make you come to realize why unions are so despicable, so counterproductive. When people have the option of choosing whether they wish to be part of a union or not, most often they choose or not. And what has happened across the country is that unions recognize this, which is why their membership is plummeting in the private sector. They only are able to maintain union membership numbers that are reasonable in the public sector and for government jobs where they ought not even be allowed to be part of unions. If you're going to work for the government, you ought not have a union. But when people have the choice in a right-to-work state, they usually vote opposed in opposition to unions. So the unions, along with liberal government politicians, have connived a system which forces membership, which forces dues. And the dues, of course, are spent trying to reelect and to fill Congress and the White House with pro-union politicians. So the pro-union politicians grant the union all sorts of concessions because it's the unions that pay for their reelection. It's why the government is broken. And it's why we find so many states on the brink of bankruptcy because of the high pensions, cost of pensions and retirement plans and upkeep, the feeding of unions, which have dominated state and local public jobs and have now priced themselves into a position that they are vastly more expensive than private sector employees. Quoting Winston Churchill can get you arrested. As one British candidate in the European elections found out after referring to the iconic wartime leader's thoughts on Islam from his book River of War, which was published in 1899. The book chronicles young Churchill's service in the Sudan at a time of Anglo-Egyptian reconquest, and the passage deals with his observations regarding Islam. Now, mind you, he was in the Sudan in 1899. Mind you, that in the late 1900s, the Islamic government of the Sudan, in genocidal rage, murdered between 2.5 and 3 million African Christians and African animists. In other words, Churchill was right. The book, as I say, chronicles that time in Churchill's life. But the passage that was quoted that has the danger of landing the Liberty GP Party chairman Paul Winston in prison for 2 years is been proven to be true. And so here's a party chairman of a Great Britain political party, Paul Winston. He's risking 2 years in prison. He has been arrested for citing a line that has been proven to be true as it relates to a book written by Winston Churchill. Winston, a candidate in the European elections in the southeast, addressed the public in Hampshire on Saturday, speaking through a megaphone, letting loose on Muslims for their improvident habits, slovenly systems of agriculture, sluggish methods of commerce, and insecurity of property, which exist wherever the followers of the prophet ruler live. Now, let's look at this. Improvident habits. Muslims have habits that are by any standard inappropriate. Like, one of their habits is they mutilate their children, their little girls. There's 125 million Muslim women today who were mutilated sexually by their parents when they were adolescents. I would say that's an improper habit. The fact that Muslims commit 99% of the world's terrorist acts today, I would call that an improvident habit, wouldn't you? I mean, they habitually commit 99% of the world's terrorist acts. That's a fair assessment. Their systems of agriculture. Do you know that almost every Islamic country is an importer of food? They're not exporters. And if you compare, we have one place where we can actually compare a Muslim husbandry to a non-Muslim. And that would be in the West Bank of Israel. And it's one of the reasons why Muslims want to confiscate it so badly is because in the West Bank you have a side-by-side comparison of farms run by Jews and farms run by Muslims. And the productivity variance is extreme. You know, Israel, prior to 1948, was just a wasteland. But since non-Muslims have returned, Jews, to the land, it has become a huge exporter of food. Their sluggish methods of commerce. There is no Islamic nation that has a prosperous economy apart from the OPEC fiefdoms. And you can't count the fact that they confiscated the Western development of their oil and now have formed a monopoly called OPEC as the means of a thriving economy. You look at Egypt. And in Egypt, the country is entirely bankrupt. They only had one viable means of economic sustenance, and it was tourism. And it wasn't tourism, it's anything that Islam had created, but in fact what had been created thousands of years before by the pharaohs. And even that now is non-existence because they're too ruthless. And so there isn't an economically prosperous Islamic country apart from OPEC. So his statement there is true. Now, if you look at the majority Islamic countries and you factor out the benefit of oil, they are among the most impoverished places on earth. His statement is true. The insecurity of property. Now, the reason that property rights are insecure in an Islamic country is because of the fact that their countries are based upon Sharia law. And in Sharia, you're based your legal system on the most disingenuous, the most sexually perverted, the most vicious terrorist who ever lived. And so if you base your legal system on the words and deeds of Muhammad, who the oldest Islamic documents demonstrate was a savage individual, you're not going to have security of property. And if you don't have security of property, you can't generate a viable economy. No one is going to be willing to invest their money and invest their energy to build a business if there isn't a reasonable chance that their investment of money and effort will produce a benefit. And in a country where the rule of law doesn't prevail, that doesn't exist. And so Muslims, right from the beginning, in fact, if you read the hadith, what you find is that Muslims never worked. Their only business was terrorism, and through terrorism, plunder. That's the golden age of Islam. That is the nature of Islam. What this man said is absolutely true. He went on to say, thousands become the brave and loyal soldiers of the faith, all know how to die, but the influence of the religion paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. You know, all you have to do there is open your eyes. Look at the conditions in the 50 majority Islamic countries. Their social development is paralyzed. And yet, Muslims are very effective at dying for their God. He went on to say, no stronger retrograde force exists in the world, far from being moribund. Muhammadism is a militant and proselytizing faith, he declared, sparking outrage in one specter who decided to bring the police. But the fact is, he was quoting Winston Churchill. Hello, Glenn. Welcome. I bet you have something to add to all of the topics we've covered so far this morning.
First of all, the word improvident is a thinly veiled reference to a different God than the God of Islam.
That is correct.
Providence providence is a Western reference to Yahweh, actually, because they would, you know, in the Anglican Church, they would
yes.
talk about Jehovah,
yeah.
or, you know, all this. But ultimately,
while you are correct in that, and it's a thinly veiled reference, it is also the whole idea of the God of Providence means the word was chosen because it conveys that which is good. And so they viewed their God as the good God. And so you can use the word as, and I'm glad you brought it up, as a thinly veiled reference to the difference between Allah and the Christian God. But it's also a word when written in the lower case would indicate that it would be unbeneficial habits.
Right.
Habits which are not beneficial.
Well, even when Christians, you know, ignorantly speak of Jehovah Jireh, they've got the Jireh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. it's still a bumbling reference to Yahweh as provider. You know.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that he chose to use that word because he was clearly meant to say ungodly habits, but he deliberately chose improvident. But anyway, there was that, and yeah, it's just amazing, like as you say, that the political protection of
right. Yeah, he was arrested. He was not allowed to finish his speech. He was arrested and hauled away for suspicion of religious or racial harassment. Now, there's no racial harassment here. He wasn't addressing a race, but instead a religion. But suspicion of religious harassment, even if what you say is true, you can't say it.
And these policies are not implemented by Muslims. They're implemented by naive secular socialists who think that they can nominalize, You know, that they can, they can emasculate or make impotent the, you know, the power of religious enmity by turning everyone into nominalists and then getting them on board with their agendas, you know. And that's just such a ridiculously naive notion when you look at all the evil being perpetrated in spite of their best efforts.
So, quoting the most famous, most articulate British politician and leader of all time, we'll get you arrested.
That was the period of his life during which he penned the boundaries of modern Iraq, I believe.
Yes.
During the time of his military service.
Yeah, I really find it interesting that what we witnessed with Donald Sterling, where even if your actions are demonstrably favorable, if your words are out of sync with what is considered politically correct, then you are going to be publicly crucified, that your vocabulary, your statements will not be allowed in society. Now, while there's a huge difference in what this man quoted and what Donald Sterling said was pure rubbish, where what this man said was absolutely accurate, there is a movement worldwide to eliminate free speech. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We are going to move on here to a new topic. It is one that I think many of us have anticipated for some time. Glenn, you are in the business, and you will be able to say much more about this than I can, although I had a lengthy discussion with my son yesterday about this particular topic. He is finishing his PhD in organic chemistry, cancer research currently. Here's the story. Research to resistance to antibiotics poses a major global threat to public health, says a new report by the World Health Organization, WHO. It analyzed data from 114 countries and said that resistance was happening now in every region of the world. It described a post-antibiotic era where people die from simple infections that had been treatable for decades. There were likely to be devastating implications unless significant actions is taken urgently, the report says. Now, it goes on, but before I continue with it, have you experienced this in hospitals and healthcare facilities that you worked in the East, Glenn?
Oh, sure. The MRSA is the big one that people know about right now, but there are others. There's MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus.
Right.
And
right.
Another well-known one is vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus, VRE, though that's less heard of. And then, like, the staph infection,
which was so prevalent in hospitals, was the first, at least, to get America's attention. But and that's why I recognize you bring that up. But what this is saying, Glenn, is that in the rest of the world, the problem is that there are now scores of infections that are now immune to antibiotics.
Right. And I would think that there's, a number of things going on. We're tending to strain at gnats and swallow camels or catch up on really old topics.
Yes.
There are a lot of things going on here. The public is just barely getting the gist of. Humanity has been, you know, the microbial world has always been at war with humanity, if you think about
Correct.
It. You know, and that's
right.
why God gave us immune systems.
Right.
You know, to fight these things, but now don't forget, man has recruited mercenaries from the microbial world to use his, you know, biological
right.
weapons. So this doesn't even touch mention that. So
right.
you know, and you don't hear much of anything about the SARS epidemic when they're spreading rapidly in
right.
Saudi Arabia right now.
Right.
Ebola making its way to Pisa, Italy. So you know, MRSA would kill slowly. Most of the resistant strain stuff, they would go up to. This is why they haven't wanted to use antibiotics as much in recent years, because they're overused.
Right.
Not in the individual, but in the gene pool as a whole is how these this resistance is developed.
Yeah, a lot of the problem, as my son explained with what you're just saying here, is that looking for a quick fix, a lot of people, particularly in the Western world, will take antibiotics for viruses, and they have no effect on the virus, but the fact that they take them at a time that that they don't have an infection that the antibiotic can target will actually create an immunity against that antibiotic. And a lot of people take an antibiotic not only too often, but for too short a period of time, which actually ends up creating a resistant strain of whatever the infection was.
Right. And it's not killing off the bacterium. Most antibiotics are for bacteria, you know.
Right, of course. Yeah. They don't affect viruses. They're good for bacteria. That's what they're good at.
And there are very few oral antifungals, so it's mostly bacteria. If you have a virus and your doctor prescribes an antibiotic, that antibiotic isn't to kill the virus. It's to prevent opportunistic infections by bacteria.
What I was saying is not that they were prescribed an antibiotic for a virus, but there are lots of people that have a virus, and they think that that their antibiotics that they may have stored on the shelves that they didn't use all of the last time will help them, when in fact at that point the antibiotic has no value to the virus and is actually creating an immunity for various bacteria infections that that may cause death later because they become untreatable.
Well, that's not in the individual. The resistance is develops in the gene pool as a whole.
Correct. That is correct.
Right.
But it's individuals who contribute to the gene pool, and this is the means that they contribute.
Right.
Yeah. We'll return on this topic when Shattering Myths continues, because the World Health Organization is saying that this could be the single greatest threat to humankind as we sit here at this moment. We'll be back.